ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
You can't have sport at this level without politics. Uh-huh. But seriously, there's no such thing as a FIFA Peace Prize. It was invented to keep Donald Trump on side and on focus to get to the deadline of a FIFA World Cup.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Australia has a new military alliance, signing a mutual defence pact with Fiji. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese put ink on paper in Suva today with his counterpart Sitiveni Rambuka. Now, Australia has had a long alliance with the US and New Zealand, but now, as of last year, there was a historic pact with Papua New Guinea to forge a new direction, and now a similar pledge made with Fiji, opening the door to the potential for a multilateral pact that could see Australia, PNG, Fiji, New Zealand and Tonga form an Ocean of Peace military alliance. But while riding high on the success of Pacific diplomacy, the Prime Minister is under fire for engaging in crude parlour games with podcasters. Welcome to Politics Now. I'm Melissa Clark, sitting in the chair for PK.
And I'm Jacob Grieber. And can I say I'm impressed that you went from high diplomacy to vulgarity in one introduction.
That's the news media business in a phrase, isn't it? We've got a lot of ground to cover, Jacob, and we will go high and we will go low.
Very low.
But let's start with the high, shall we? We've got Anthony Albanese in Fiji. Now, he's done two things. He's signed the Vivale Union. So this is a broad strategic and economic agreement with Fiji. But he's also signed a mutual defence pact and opened up the possibility of there being a multilateral defence pact. Now, this is significant because what it does is it calls for the two countries to come to each other's that they would act to meet a common danger. This is really strong language. This is a mutual defence pact, as Anthony Albanese put it. An attack on Fiji from an outside force would trigger Australia's support and vice versa. This is also what we saw signed with Papua New Guinea back in October last year. So, Jacob, it's a pretty big deal to go from having a long historic agreement with the US and New Zealand as formal alliances for decades, and then suddenly in the last 12 months, we've got two new alliances with Pacific partners.
Yeah, well, I think that's the sort of line, isn't it, today? He's double in it's not even 12 months, because I think the PNG one doesn't officially come into force for another 2 days, the Prime Minister was saying. So, I mean, you could shorten it. In the space of 2 weeks, he's doubled our alliances since 1951. You know, so he's been busy, put it that way. They're significant. They're a sign of the times, I think. China was the unnamed, virtually unnamed, overriding sort of elephant in the room with that whole discussion where we saw both prime ministers heralding this big new agreement. As you say, they're looking to expand it to other states. And that, of course, there's technical problems there because obviously some of the states don't have real significant military capability. So if you have a treaty of this kind, that's sort of meaningless. They'll have to find some other way of doing that.
Yeah, exactly. But the countries have been talked about, Tonga, along with PNG, Fiji, New Zealand and Australia. Yeah. They're the countries in the Pacific that have militaries.
So it's this arc of influence idea that we're forming. The strategic community likes to talk about Australia's, you know, enmeshing itself, and those countries are getting more connected with us, and it's all about essentially becoming the preferred partner in the Prime Minister's language. I don't know. Does it? The question for me, I guess, is how far do these treaties go in practice? Because we're talking here about some very, very small countries.
We are. I think there's a couple of things that are important here. I don't think if anyone thought World War III was going to break out and Australia was under attack as an ally of the US that, you know, the Republic of Fiji, military forces are necessarily going to be a deciding factor in how we go. But what this is about doing is trying to buttress China's growing influence. And China has worked in a step-by-step, grey zone-by-grey zone approach to the Pacific, looking to make small gains, integrate into their institutional systems, try and make progress in areas of infrastructure that are dual use. Australia is trying to draw a line before it gets to a point of conflict where we need to get to a common danger. And what it has seen is a change in the political climate in the Pacific. Like, it's one thing for us to look at Australia and go, well, it's clear what Australia's motivation here is. You know, we want to try and keep China's influence at bay, and we've managed to convince Pacific partners to do this. But we've also seen a change in perspective from Pacific leaders, and like their willingness to engage in this is a key element here. And I think we see in recent years, James Marape coming to the leadership in Papua New Guinea and Sitiveni Rambuka coming to the leadership in Fiji. These are two very big and prominent and influential Melanesian players in Pacific politics. These are two leaders who have tried to reset their democracies and their economic directions of their countries since coming into power in recent years. These sorts of deals couldn't have been signed a couple of years ago with their predecessors.
I think that's such an interesting point about how the landscape's changed. I think it's actually changed in the Pacific, as you've just described, but politically in Australia, it's a very different government to what it was 4 years ago. Throw your mind back to the previous coalition government. They were having all sorts of issues with the Pacific. These concerns about China were live then. They really started to emerge. I mean, recall former ACT Senator Zed Seselja being dispatched in the middle of an election campaign to try and hose down concerns. I think it was over the Solomons at the time.
It was Solomon Islands. It was to go to Honiara, where Vanessa Sogavare had signed an agreement with China. Yeah,
so things would really deteriorate. And then you also had the Pacific was quite sceptical, I think, of that government for its attitude to climate change. And I thought it was really telling that Prime Minister Rambuka mentioned climate change, how for Fiji this is not a theoretical debate, it's a lived crisis, they are in it now. The fact that he made that statement made me wonder how would it play if there was a different government, if it was the coalition in power right now, especially the current version of the coalition. Remember, Morrison did sign up to net zero. But the coalition is now so deeply sceptical of things like Paris. In fact, you know, there's a push among that side of politics to get out of Paris. How would that play? How would that enable them to enmesh Australia with these important Pacific partners?
I think this is really interesting because when I've heard from Ted O'Brien talk about, you know, he recently went to the Pacific, is looking to engage, has thrown his weight behind, you know, the Solomon Islands idea of a regional security pact. And when he's asked about this question of, but how is the Pacific responding to you as a party that isn't as firmly committed to action on climate when the Pacific sees it as a number one existential threat, the number one security threat for them? And he says, oh, no, they don't raise that with me. It's not an issue because they don't raise it with me. We talk on security. I think the point is it's not being raised because they don't believe they're going to get any traction or progress from the coalition, but they raise it every single time with the government. Well, they raise it in meetings between themselves, like between Pacific nation to Pacific nation. I think the coalition needs to hear not that, oh, this isn't a problem because it's not being raised with us. They need to see it's a problem because it's not being raised with them.
Yes,
does that make sense?
Well, I think what you're suggesting is they don't want to have an uncomfortable, impolite conversation with Ted O'Brien when he visits those countries. But there's nothing clearer, nothing more overt than hearing the Fijian Prime Minister talk about it. He didn't need to. It's a security pact. It doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with climate change, but that is a number one issue in that part of the world, one of the top issues. And I think I'm not saying a future coalition government wouldn't be able to do some of these deals, but I think it feels like it'd be much, much harder for them.
Well, it's very awkward because there is the Bow Declaration, which the Pacific Island Forum nations have signed, which of course Australia is a member of, which recognises that climate is the number one security issue. So even though you say, look, this is a security pact, it's a different thing. In a Pacific mindset, it's not a different thing. They see it as one and the same. And I think that does raise challenges if we were to have a climate sceptical coalition government in power, that these sorts of relationships are much, much harder to build when there is a fundamental disagreement about what the number one problem is.
Now,
this trip is not over for the Prime Minister. There's quite a bit of diplomacy to be undertaken. Tomorrow, Anthony Albanese is going to Honiara to speak with the Prime Minister of Solomon Islands, Matthew Wale. There's obviously discussions happening with him about a security arrangement. Then they're all going to basically gather in Brisbane, of course, well-timed with the State of Origin decider that is going to be taking place.
So cynical of you, Mel.
Well, it's not.
It's just a coincidence that the Origin decider is on that night.
It's not. No one's even pretending it's a coincidence because everyone acknowledges that NRL is like a number one diplomatic tool when it comes to Pacific relations, right? So James Marape, the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, will be there. There will be more information about how Australia's funding to PNG's NRL team.
PNG Chiefs. Is that what they're called? I'm not an NRL follower, but I gather that that's a much anticipated arrival in the competition.
As someone who grew up in Victoria, the NRL is not my native game, but from the small amounts of time that I've spent in Port Moresby, it is very clear to me how important this sport is in the country. And part of the agreement that has come with the security arrangements between Australia and Papua New Guinea is for more funding in the region, not just Papua New Guinea, but other countries as well, that will support grassroots development of sport. So that's part of the rationale of everyone gathering in Brisbane as the State of Origin is happening. So that's going to be big. And then, Jacob, after that, it's Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, coming to Australia. What is Anthony Albanese hoping to get out of a meeting with the leader of one of the biggest economies in our area?
One of the biggest economies, massive, diaspora connections to Australia, between India and Australia. Whenever Modi comes to Australia, he tends to do things like fill entire stadiums. There's few world leaders on earth that can pull that kind of a crowd.
Well, he's going to be expecting him to do this. Docklands and MCG.
Yeah, so I think you might see whether he can beat Taylor Swift's sort of crowd record. We'll have to check it out. But yeah, it'll be a big show. It's a very important one, obviously. The economic connections are massive between India and Australia. There are also very serious, meaningful security arrangements. The Quad has been sort of on the back burner, really, ever since Trump came back and almost immediately picked a fight with India by slapping tariffs on India. That seemed to have weakened that Quad core, which is, of course, the four-way. It's not a treaty, it's not an alliance, but it's an agreement.
It's a dialogue.
A dialogue between Japan, the US, Australia, and India. Now, this, I think, is part of keeping that alive. So that would be underlay to that.
I think the Quad is on life support while Trump is in office, and then there's hope that the next president of the US, that might become a more fruitful point of discussion. But it does make those bilateral talks more important in the meantime. It's probably also worth flagging they're likely to talk about uranium. Australia has uranium exports to India, but there are issues around a lot of the technical arrangements. It was very controversial at the time when Australia first set up arrangements to export because they're not a signatory to the non-proliferation treaty, and they had to put up all these separate arrangements around, you know, ensuring security and separation of civilian and military nuclear use. But there is a big push to export more uranium to India. So I think we might see some details behind the stadium madness that there will be. There'll be a little bit of that. But Jacob, we spent a lot of time talking high-level diplomacy. Is it time to go
down, go low?
Take us into the mud. Take us there, Jacob.
Okay, look, well, I was trying to ignore this over the weekend, but I did see the Prime Minister had done a podcast. And, you know, just so our dear listeners don't have to get through the entire 18, 19 minutes of it. I did listen to it on my bike ride into work this morning. It's certainly not the kind of podcast that you would go on to learn about diplomacy or deep policy or
didn't get any tax policy arrangements.
CGT versus negative gearing. No, this is pretty light and fluffy and a bit larrikin and definitely on the cruder side of the spectrum. Nothing wrong with any of that. Of course, the Prime Minister did get into some sticky ground when he played that, we agreed to play that stupid game of, you know, what is it? Marry,
shag, date, something like that.
Thank you, Mel.
Shag was the word, I think.
And the Prime Minister walked straight into it, protested briefly to say that he'd only been married 6 months. Bush Barbie, I think is her name.
I think she calls herself Bush Barbie.
Nom de plume.
Yes.
Pressed him, of course, in an almost true journalistic style. She didn't let him get away with his first answer. And he said, yes, well, Kylie Minogue would be the one that he would do all three of those things to. And the shit has hit the fan ever since, if I can use that word.
Yeah, there are a number of crude moments. I mean, much of the podcast was filled with double entendres, right? So there were landmines left, right and centre for Anthony Albanese. He managed to walk into multiple of them. There were other references to being in the honeymoon period. And
I actually thought some of the other stuff was more cringy, way more cringy.
Talking about how a south wind would be an aphrodisiac.
Yes, how amorous he gets after a game of football. Like, no, I don't. There's some stuff I don't need to know, Prime Minister. That's some of it. But don't go and listen to it, dear listener, if you don't want to have those thoughts. But the more serious thing, I think, is there was a considerable number of people who did find that really beneath a Prime Minister,
That it was unbecoming of someone in the role.
Right. And I think the other thing people sort of maybe tested themselves on was, what if it was someone else? Like, say you like Albanese, say you like this Prime Minister, you might forgive him for this. It's larrikin, it's a bit jokey, it's a bit silly. But then superimpose a different Prime Minister who you didn't like, and then you can see that actually that really wouldn't be very acceptable and people would have a problem with it. That's the danger. Humour is so dangerous. When humour and politics come together, it's oil and water.
It's highly subjective as well, but it's a very exposing strategy, right? Like, the Prime Minister has made a point of engaging very closely with social media influencers. We've seen that even in budget coverage, inviting prominent political social media influencers in to take part. He does a lot of these kind of interviews with Australians with big followings on YouTube and other platforms.
He does a lot of those FM channels as well.
And he does a lot of FM radio. So he's always been prepared to engage and sees that as a way of reaching people who might not consume the news. And there's a laudable aspect to that, right?
Well, you go where the audience is.
But the question is, how far is he willing to engage in some of the shenanigans that come up to it? And he gets quite relaxed in these interviews, and you can't help but think back to the Future Victoria Summit hosted by the Herald Sun last year, where he was sort of goaded into a word association game about a number of individuals, and he was asked about Grace Tame, and he sort of paused and said difficult, and you know, combustion, oil and water moment right there. I think some of the backlash has been questions about his judgment about when to weigh in, when to be jokey and larrikin-like and try to be open to an audience. And when does he, as Prime Minister, just not need to play games? And is he making the right calls about when to say, look, this is all good and well, but I'm the Prime Minister, I'm just not going to answer that? And is he making the wrong judgment call? I think that is a reasonable question.
It's a
to
fair
ask.
Question. And I was talking to some others about that very question this morning. And those are the two examples that now come up. Okay, today's one and the one with Grace Tame. I mean, I'm not defending or saying he should be forgiven, because he has actually apologised, which is a recognition that he knows it's wrong. He's apologised for it unreservedly. But if they're the two atrocities, quote unquote, in 4 years of being Prime Minister, where he has done untold dozens of these kinds of interviews, it's a pretty good strike rate. I mean, I'm not, you know, he's managed to get through. I don't know how many hundreds of FM channels he's been on in those years, but he does it a lot. It does get very kind of lighthearted. I think the other thing, this particular program, the irony of it is he was talking with this comedian.
Nikki Osborne is her name.
Yeah, she's sort of the Philomena Kunk of Australian bush politics, I suppose, isn't she? BBC classic.
Don't get us in trouble here, Jacob.
So where I think they were bonding was actually about how these pylons happen in social media. How things get taken out of context. That the irony of it is, of course, that some of the headlines have been, you know, pretty dramatic for what was a really stupid, silly bit of radio or podcasting, I should say. And I think the other thing was he was very supportive of her pushing back against social media trolls, some of which sounds quite misogynistic, aimed at her, you know, complaining about her teeth or whatever. And she's had quite a bit of cut through, I think, in the way that she's countered that. And I think the Prime Minister was trying to align himself. Anyway, he's ended up getting covered, hasn't he?
The bit that really struck me was before some of those remarks were even made, there's a point where he says, "I've thought all sorts of things. It's best not to say some things. Some things are best left unsaid." And then he failed to take his own advice
probably
on that front.
Probably good advice for all of us, isn't it?
Look, while we're talking about the difficulties the Prime Minister is facing, there is the ongoing issue of the federal government's gambling reforms, which have been introduced to Parliament and now being examined by a parliamentary inquiry, but have been pretty broadly criticised for not going far enough, of not meeting the challenge set down by the Murphy report to have a comprehensive ban of gambling advertising. Adding on to that, over the weekend, we've had the New South Wales Labor Party State Conference, and they had a motion that was accepted unanimously to really crack down on poker machines. So it included a moratorium on new poker machine licenses, higher taxes on clubs that raise a lot of revenue from gaming and gambling, and halving the number of machines that can be traded between venues. Now, the Minns government isn't bound by this, but it's certainly going to be influenced by this. What do you think this says about the ground in which Anthony Albanese is trying to get the crackdown on gambling advertising through? Not only is he now facing backlash from the Greens, the crossbench, and even the coalition federally saying it doesn't go far enough, now Labor Party is getting its own voice and indicating more needs to be done in tackling gambling.
Yeah, this issue just doesn't seem to be able to be managed away by the Prime Minister in the way he has wanted to. It's 3 years since the Peter Murphy report, I think just over that. That's the late Peter Murphy commissioned, or was rather the head of a committee that looked into this, came up with a whole bunch of recommendations, essentially to end gambling advertising during sporting events. They've tried to manage that. There's a lot of pushback from the big broadcasters. Last week, the Senate stunned the government, I think to some extent, by actually delaying legislation they were trying to force through. And there's another inquiry now that the Senate will be chewing into this matter. They'll get more witnesses, hear more stories of the harm. We saw a Liberal junior frontbencher, Simon Kennedy, talking about the sort of harm, talking in quite emotional terms about the sort of harm that is caused by gambling. So it's not going away. The Prime Minister doesn't seem to be able to manage this to get it off the agenda because he doesn't want it to be on the agenda. And as you say, now New South Wales has come in, not binding on the feds, but it leads into the national conference in about 2 weeks' time.
One of the things that's really struck me with the government trying to get the passage of this legislation through, in some ways, we've looked at the composition of this Senate and said it's very friendly to Labor. It can team up with the coalition to pass legislation through the Senate, or it can team up with the Greens to pass legislation through, and it can play them off against each other. That gives Labor a lot of power. But what it does mean is that if the Greens and the coalition agree on something, it's very hard for Labor to progress, because it's not a case of trying to pick off one or two crossbenchers that makes the difference between legislation passing or not passing. It's convincing two big parties and determined and united parties, not always united, maybe on the coalition front, but the dynamic that is often leaves Labor in a position of power when the coalition and Greens agree, Labor has very few options. And at this point, the coalition is indicating it is going to force Labor to make concessions. And the fact that the Greens are on the same side of the argument, wanting more action, does give the coalition quite a powerful position at this point, I think.
Yeah, you're right, Mel. And I think the other interesting thing, maybe you've heard similar, the government's anger about this is not directed really at the Greens. They know the Greens' position. The anger is actually directed at Angus Taylor. And there was also the social media ban amendments that the government was trying to get through, doubling the penalties on the big tech companies and giving the e-safety commissioner the power.
They clearly expected the coalition to rush it through quickly.
Exactly. They thought they would all be very easy to manage in the Senate. And there was real anger from the government at Angus Taylor. The accusation was that he had lost control of the party on those two issues. Well, I think on the social media ban, they're being tactical. It's not the opposition's job to fix the government's problems and mistakes, politics being politics. Mm. But on the gambling thing, I think there is a genuine split in the coalition. There are voices that are more on side with the government's position. I think you saw some of that hesitation, for instance, with Senator Henderson. It was others who came out from the party room who were noisy about wanting to go with what turned out to be the Greens' position. So I think there's a bit of frustration in the government that they don't have a reliable partner there. Yeah.
Jacob,
numbers matter.
We've gone high, we've gone low, and we've gone back to high policy detail at the end. I think we should leave now while we're on a high before we dip down low
again.
What do you think?
Anything else at this point?
All right, that's it for politics now. Thank you for joining me, and we'll be back tomorrow. We'll bring you all the latest developments. And of course, if you have any questions for us, you can always send through a short voice note to theparty room@abc.net.au. Bye, Jacob.
See you, Mel.